This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. This is our weekly director's cut of the show, a selection of carefully curated conversations from the archive. First, the difference deep kindness can make. Then, scientists have long debated how people managed to populate tiny Polynesian islands in the ocean. Was it by accident? Where'd they come from? New DNA analysis offers some clues. Also, how Feb Burns' letter to her son, a member of the Tennessee State House, helped to give American women the right to vote. That's ahead on Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. When was the last time you did something intentionally kind, something that required you to step outside of your comfort zone or summon an uncomfortable amount of forgiveness and compassion? It's not enough to be nice, says Houston Kraft. The world needs deep kindness. That's the title of his book. He's a motivational speaker who travels the country doing kindness boot camps for schools with a program he co-created called Character Strong. I spoke with Houston Kraft back in the fall. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. I mean, the thing I was wondering reading this book was, like, what kind of person decides to make themselves like the preacher of kindness and then travel the country and have to be kind all the time? Like, how do you even maintain that?
I know. I backed myself into a kind corner, unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure. But it does hold you accountable, for sure.
There must be times, though, where you feel like, I need to give myself a pass on kindness today, or for the next for the next 2 hours, I cannot be kind, so I'm going to stay home and not talk to anybody.
Yeah. You know, one of the ironies of kindness is that it does require more boundaries than I think our world gives it credit to. I love that research from Dr. Brené Brown. She says in all of her sort of codified interview, she discovered that the most compassionate people are also the most boundaried, which means they actually say no a lot.
Hmm. How did this get started for you, your decision to be the kindness guy?
I think it started with a sort of a paradigm shift around the word for me. When I was in high school, I think we hear that we're supposed to be kind from the time we're really little. But I had a chance to go to a summer camp, a leadership summer camp in Washington State where I grew up. And I sort of had this paradigm shift that true kindness or compassion, that love was much more unconditional and required a lot more intentional choice and sacrifice of me than I think I thought it did at the time. And so when I went back to school, I think it was really my senior year of high school, everything started to change for me. The way I looked at people and the way that I looked at my responsibility as a person in my school, as a leader in my school, changed. And that's, nearly two decades ago now. And I've tried to figure out more and more over the years, what does it look like to actually practice meaningful, deep kindness in my life?
Can you describe an interaction that you had that senior year in high school that you feel like you did a good job on the deep kindness front?
Yeah, I was elected student body president at my school, I think perhaps only because I knew what the word liaison meant and the people that I was going up against didn't. And we were asked publicly in front of the school to define it. So that got me through. And as student body president, one of my goals was to try to make every student on my campus feel accepted, belonging, safe, loved. And I had this conversation with a student who was otherwise marginalized in a lot of ways. And I feel lucky because he came to me. And I suppose I feel proud because I took the time to listen. And he said, there's a huge population at this school, really the silent majority, who don't care about so many of the things that the leadership typically puts on. And he's like, we want a voice. And so together, him and I created this organization on campus called the Silent Voices, where I wasn't a part of the meetings, but he brought together students from a bunch of different groups to have more of a safe space to have a voice on campus. And then he would relay those things back to me. So I think like this, the practice of structured listening is something I'm most proud of from high school.
How do you teach that? Can you share explain an exercise that you use with students in your Character Strong program where you're helping them to understand how to listen in a kind and compassionate way?
Yeah, I think part of it is understanding what empathy actually is. And, there's a lot of misinterpretations of that word. I think we all want a more empathetic world, but Dr. Jamil Zaki out of Stanford, he had a great book called The War on Kindness. And he says that empathy is actually an umbrella term that encapsulates a few different skills. he breaks them down in a nice simplified way into sharing, thinking, and caring. So one of the things that we do with students and adults alike, right? These are all skills we can work on, is talk about what are the skills that support an empathetic, you know, listening life. The first one, sharing, which is understanding what people are feeling. And one of the exercises we offer is a menu of emotion words to allow us to tap into what we are actually feeling and sort of maybe the bigger category. I think we have a tendency to say, oh, I'm mad or sad or glad, right? We have these like basic feelings, but there's actually like sort of minutia there that we can unpack. Like, maybe I'm not mad, maybe I'm disappointed. And those things are different. Maybe I'm not sad, maybe I'm actually lonely. And giving young people, and really all of us, a greater emotional vocabulary for ourselves helps us better understand what other people are feeling, right? When I have a better orientation of what I'm actually feeling, I can better sense that in others. That's what Dr. Zaki was called sharing, right? Affective empathy. Then there's thinking, which is perspective taking. The ability to think about how someone would experience an event based on their reality, their needs, and not my own. And that requires a lot of what would be called mentalizing, which is like, how do I actually historicize someone well enough to contextualize their experience? So this might hurt me, whatever the circumstance is, in one way, but based on their reality, based on where they grew up, based on their faith, based on their race, based on their gender, based on their orientation, based on all these different things that make them them, how might they experience a given emotion or circumstance? And then the last one is caring. And I think this one's actually a really big deal, because we can feel empathy, we can feel bad for someone and never actually do anything to alleviate that hurt. We do it all the time. So caring is what in psychology they would call empathetic concern or compassionate action. How do we take feeling and perspective taking and actually mobilize it towards kindness? And we talk a lot about specificity, right? The more specific you can get with an action, the more meaningful it's going to be to that person. And specificity also helps me become more action oriented in my life, instead of just like, just go be kind. What does that actually mean? Well, it means meeting people's legitimate needs, because I've thought about what they feel and thought about their circumstances in a way that I can more effectively meet those needs.
That makes me think about the story about the woman you call Helga in your book, who you say in some ways this book is written for her. Tell us about Helga.
Yeah, I met Helga on an air. I spent a lot of time on airplanes in a career of speaking. I would wander to different schools, and I was on an airplane every other day. And so early on in my speaking career, I hadn't earned any sort of status on an airline. So I was in the middle seat. I call it the hot dog seat, because people's buns are on either side of me. And I'm sitting there, and this woman shows up, and to make a semi-long story, semi-short, we were talking about kindness, and she was trying to communicate to me how important it was to her by sharing a story of how the last time she was on an airplane was en route to go visit her dad, who she learned was headed to the hospital. She had to get on a plane to go visit him. And literally as she's about to take off on this plane to go see her dad, she gets the phone call that she's lost him. She has to sit next to strangers for 3 hours on this airplane. She doesn't have any cell service. Finally, she lands at the airport, gets off the plane, walks up to the nearest wall, and just crumbles. And as she's describing the story to me, she says, Houston, I sat in that airport for 2 hours. Over the course of that 2 hours, there's probably, you know, 3,000 people in that airport going to their planes or getting off their plane. She goes, 2 hours, 3,000 people, and not one. Not a single person stopped. And she looks at me, she goes, you have no idea how much I could have used an act of kindness that day. And I think about Helga often. In fact, I probably talk about her, think about Helga every day at this point. I've never talked to her or met her again, but I think about that circumstance. And the story for me drives self-reflection. You know, would I have stopped? And you think about the 3,000 people that did walk by, that they didn't stop for Helga. And you ask, how many of them do you think would say they believe in kindness? And I would suggest all of them. Right. I've never talked to anyone like, hey, what do you think about kindness? They're like, eh, it's all right. We all agree it's a good thing. And yet there can be often this gap between what we say is worthwhile and what we actually do for each other. Well, and that's why that empathy piece is so important, right? We can feel bad and not do anything to alleviate suffering.
What could anyone do, though? What would stopping have accomplished? I guess that's sometimes, not to excuse my inclination to keep on walking, like to feel like, oh, that person's having a hard day. Nothing I can do about it. I'm not going to interfere in their personal activities. You know, like, I don't want to pry. I don't know that person. I'm going to keep on walking. I think that's a pretty common reaction, right? Probably a lot of those 3,000 people walking by were thinking that. What does kindness look like in that case?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite sort of definitions of action-oriented empathy is suffering with. In fact, that's what the Latin translation of the word compassion means, to suffer alongside someone. And in psychology, they would say compassion is to suffer alongside someone and have an active desire to alleviate that suffering. So what does that look like in that situation? Mm. It's a great question. It's kind of what the whole book orients around, around is this idea of asking ourselves, what gets in the way of our most profound opportunities to exercise kindness? And the book breaks it down into three parts. It's incompetence, insecurity, and inconvenience. And I think probably all three of those play a role in that moment you're describing of. The first one is like, what could I do to help? That question, in many ways, the ability to ask that question suggests that I might not have all the tools in the toolbox to be helpful in that situation. So what are the competencies that would allow me to A, better diagnose what Helga might be dealing with? And do I know what sort of questions, or do I have the capacity to listen to someone, even a stranger, and allow that listening to make them feel safe or heard in that moment? Insecurity would be, what are the things that I'm scared of? Like, you know, if I sit down with this person, are they going to dismiss me? Am I going to actually be rejected when I extend a moment of generosity? Because that stinks. It stinks to have someone, right? When we try to do good and we get rejected in return, it decreases our likelihood to extend compassion again. Or what if I don't know what to say, right? That fear of failure. What if I have shame of my own around my own life? Like, you know, I have my own stuff going on. How could I possibly be helpful to this woman? And then there's inconvenience, which is like, you know, I'm busy. I got things to do. I got a flight to catch. I got 1,000 emails to write. I don't have time to stop and help this person who's hurting. And I think all three of those, right? And all three of those have legitimacy in our life. Like, if I truly don't know what to do to help, it makes sense that I walk on by. If I truly am late for this next flight and I have a family to go back to, or I'm heading to a funeral, like, those things are obviously very real circumstances of our life. But I would say that a lot of people in that airport just give themselves that first round of excuse, which is, this person maybe doesn't want my help, or I don't have time to help, or what could I possibly do to help? And if we don't have more tools in our toolbox to diagnose exactly what's going on, then we'll all walk by Helga.
Right. So in order to overcome the incompetence piece of it, you have to have done some work to develop some skills so that when a Helga presents herself, you know how to listen compassionately. You at least have the confidence that you know how to be present with someone and not make it worse.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorite paradigm shifts that I try to offer in the book is the distinction between our to-do list and our to-be list. You know, we all have these things that we want to be. We want to be present, or we want to be grateful, or we want to be generous, or we want to be kind. But sometimes, you know, our culture tells us that our to-do list is the most important thing, that productivity is the thing that matters most. And so the irony, of course, is that those to-be list items, because they're just sort of abstract enough, they typically get deprioritized in our day-to-day routines and actions. But the suggestion of the book is, if we really care about those things in the way that we collectively claim to, we would allocate more of our time and attention more thoughtfully. So my challenge would be to, like, write out a one item to-be list right above your to-do list, which takes an abstract word like kindness or presence and assigns an actual to-do list item for your day. So maybe that to-be list is, I want to be present today, which means I'm going to make a 10-minute phone call to my aunt, who I don't usually talk to, and just check in. I'm not going to be distracted by anything else, but I'm going to listen today. That's on my to-be list.
This is not the kind of scatter sunshine, sprinkle random acts of kindness mentality that I think comes to mind for a lot of people when they think about kindness. Like, oh, what I need to do is bake cookies for somebody and drop it on their doorstep. Or, you know, be the one that's always waving and smiling, which is great. But this is like a whole different category of being what you're describing.
Yeah, you know, I think that's part of the challenge. I think it's one of the reasons why we collectively say kindness is important, and yet we're collectively we miss opportunities for some of those moments because the way we speak about it, the way we see it in culture is more of that, how I describe it in the book, is confetti kindness, which don't get me wrong, like those things are worthwhile. Please do bake cookies and bring them over. I'm all for it. But does that actually address some of the deeper struggles that we're navigating as humans right now? Does that address some of the broken systems that we're dealing with? No, it feels a little bit more like the band-aids or the quick fixes that feel good in the moment, but maybe don't always drive meaningful change.
Houston Croft, are there barriers to kindness that we face today that you think are new or distinct? I guess I'm just thinking about American society, the things that we have in our lives right now. Are there certain things that we're dealing with that are barriers to this kind of kindness?
Yeah, I mean, I think for speaking to Americans specifically, we have, particularly obviously, the political polarization is going to be one of the number one ways that we other each other. And anytime we put it into us and them, we reduce our capacity for empathetic listening. That's one of the things that we are presently experiencing.
Yeah.
More collectively, we're experiencing an increase in anxiety. That's a global thing, but US is leading the pack in terms of that growth of anxiety. Some of that has to do with the advent of social media, but that's just been true about what our culture asks of us, right? We get asked to be more productive for less time off and less money as inflation rises. And we experience, right? Dr. Michelle Borba in her book, she says, as anxiety goes up, empathy goes down. And that's what we're experiencing as a culture. Suicide has taken over homicide as the number two killer of teenagers. There's reasons why that is real. And a lot of it has to do with the cultural pressure that we put on all of us, but particularly young people, that reduce our ability to be kind because I'm so worried about what's going on in my world, right? We have this culture in the US of individualism and independence and entrepreneurship that, if not handled carefully, orients all of our success towards productivity. You know, one of my least favorite studies about kindness, because it frustrates me, comes out of Harvard's Making Caring Common project. Dr. Richard Weisbord asked families, he goes, hey, rank in order what you want for your young people, your children. Do you want them to be high performing, happy, or kind? 1, 2, and 3. Like 80 something percent of families said they would rather their kids be happy and kind over high performing, which feels like good news. But then they asked the kids of those same parents, hey, what do you think your parents want you to be? High performing, happy, or kind? And the data was the exact opposite. So what we say is important, and what we actually make important with our actions are two different things. And I think that's why young people feel frustrated and feel this sort of sense of disconnection, because you say you want me to be kind and happy. And yet all the questions that you ask and all my metrics of success are all about achievement. So what are we really communicating on a day-to-day basis?
Give me one thing that parents could do today with their kids to start this process of instilling the importance of kindness.
If we're talking total simple, where we can start is in the questions that we ask. I borrow this from my friend Keith Hawkins. He asked a room full of 4,000 students. I saw him do this live. Hey, how many of you have had a parent or guardian in the past month ask you the question, what did you do for others today? Not how was your day? Not what did you learn today? What did you do for others today? And in a room of 4,000 students, zero hands went up. So if there's one practical way to start, build that question implicitly and explicitly into the daily conversation you have with the young people you spend time with, your children. What did you do for others today?
Houston Croft is the co-founder of Character Strong, author of the book Deep Kindness. I spoke with him last fall. This is Top of Mind, Prime Cuts. It's our weekly staff picks version of the show. Coming up in about 15 minutes, how a mother's letter led Tennessee to ratify the 19th Amendment and give women the vote nationwide. Just ahead, DNA analysis is helping to solve the mystery of how tiny Polynesian islands in the ocean first became populated. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Welcome. It's great to have you with us. I'm Julie Rose. How did the tiny islands in the Pacific Ocean become populated? There have been debates among scientists about this for centuries. DNA analysis is providing new, more conclusive evidence of ancient people traveling back and forth across the Pacific Ocean from Asia to the Polynesian Islands to South America and back. All of this, of course, long before modern technology. Last summer, I spoke with statistical researcher Alexander Ioannidis at Stanford University, who had recently published some of his DNA analysis on this subject. And we were also joined by Keolu Fox, an anthropologist at UC San Diego who studies the Polynesian Islands. Let's listen back. So if we could start with you, Professor Fox, describe for us just a bit about the mystery of these islands and how they became populated. Tell us what some of the various theories have been that scientists have floated over the years.
Ooh, floated. I like what you did there. So I think it's just important to recognize that this is one of the most remote places on planet Earth. You know, the Polynesian Triangle is about the size of the Eurasian continent, so Europe plus Asia. And our wayfinding ancestors were able to, you know, make our way over and navigate and identify some of the most remote places in the world using some pretty sophisticated scientific knowledge. And this happened, you know, a few thousand years ago, and research from Alex and others kind of solidified some ideas about about how far did the Polynesian ancestors go. And it is a kind of really cool contribution to the field.
Has it historically been thought that, I mean, the initial Polynesian, the humans had to get to the islands at some point, right? They got there from somewhere. Has the thinking been primarily that they came from where?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is often called by, you know, some traditional wayfinders from the Polynesian and Hawaiian community, specifically the community that I'm a part of, as the original moonshot. So it's believed that our ancestors kind of left out of the Taiwan area, then end up, you know, in the Bismarck Archipelago, and then there's sort of radiations out from there in that region of the world into these really remote, far-flung island archipelagos. That's one theory, the more popular theory. That's basically all of the lines of scientific evidence sort of support this idea. Then there was another kind of theory that was popularized back in the day, that the radiation and migratory history of that diaspora could have occurred coming from South America, the other direction, and then into Polynesia. And that is kind of like where the controversy sort of originated.
Right. Did, like, which from, side did it come
yeah,
from?
Yeah, which direction did the radiation occur from? And I think, like, we've pretty much conclusively hit it on the nose that those that believed it came from South America, with the exception of, you know, nuanced approaches to this, the majority of that radiation and diaspora occurred from the other direction.
Not from South America. Alexander Ioannidis, talk to us about the one theory. There's kind of this very famous story, the Kon-Tiki experiment that took place that for a while gained a lot of traction. I guess this was like in the 1800s, right? That people thought, well, hey, maybe the Polynesian Islands were populated kind of just by accident. Can you describe what that theory was?
Sure. So the Kon-Tiki voyage was in the second half of the 1900s. I think it was in the late 1950s.
Oh, okay.
That was before
fairly recent.
At all. But the theory, as you're right, goes back a long way before. So there's a man, John McMillan Brown, who had written a book about it in the 1920s. And even before that, in the 1800s, as you mentioned, it had been noticed that there were some linguistic connections between the word for sweet potato, actually, in the Polynesian languages, and the word that's used on the coast of South America. And so based on that, there were some ideas that maybe there was a connection there. And the Kon-Tiki voyage was Thor Heyerdahl's attempt to demonstrate that it was possible for a drift voyage using the technology at the time on the coast of South America to reach the Polynesian Islands.
So just by getting in the water off the coast of South America and sort of just like floating for 100 days and see if you run into one of these tiny islands in this vastness of the Pacific Ocean. And in fact, they did.
They did. In fact, the island that Thor ran into is in the Tuamotus, which is one of the areas where we found this Native American ancestry signature.
Okay, so talk to us about how DNA is helping to solve this riddle. What specifically, whose DNA were you looking at?
Right, so we looked at DNA from individuals from a number of Polynesian islands in the remote eastern Polynesian region. And also...
So eastern, would that be on the side closest to the Americas?
That's right. So the islands that might be the most likely to have had contact. And then we looked at populations on the west coast of the Americas for the same reason. So indigenous populations, Native Americans, from Mexico all the way down to the coast of Chile. So that we could kind of try to identify if there was ancestry in Polynesia, where it came from.
So that you could actually look at the DNA of a modern person living on one of these Polynesian islands, and you could see distinct markers that would say, yes, someone from an indigenous community on the American continent is in this family tree somewhere.
Yeah. So the way it sort of works, if you want to visualize it, is if you can picture DNA as a long series of like coin flips. So whether you have a variant or you don't. And if you have a specific sequence in a row of exactly the same coin flips, so you can imagine flipping a coin, 30 times in a row and two people got exactly the same sequence, that can't happen by chance. That's just very, very low probability. It means that you had the same ancestor somewhere back who had that exact DNA sequence. And so that's the sort of thing we were looking at, these patterns that tell us there was a connection between these populations.
And so do you find a lot of Native American, indigenous to the American continent DNA in modern Polynesian island residents?
No, we don't. We don't find much at all. It's only on a few islands. And on those islands, it's very small. It's maybe about 2%. So this was a small event. But it did happen.
And when you say small event, what do you mean by that?
Well, we can't say exactly how many. That's not something we're able to do with the data we have now. But a much, much smaller number of people who from the Americas than the Polynesians who are on the island.
Okay. And can you tell that there's a lot of DNA from the Asian side of the migration path then?
Exactly. The 98%, all the remainder is from that side. That's right.
Huh. Okay. And you say you found evidence of this Native American DNA in some people on some of the islands. Are they the islands that are closest to South America?
Yes, they're the easternmost islands. That's right. So it makes some sense that's where we would find it.
Okay. And so what do you think, Professor Ioannidis, happened? What do you think happened? How did this DNA get into these Polynesian residents of these islands?
So we can't say for sure genetically. We can only say that the populations came into contact and had children together, basically. Hmm. But what I think, and Kaolu could speak more to this, is that we know that there was a real voyaging technology there, and really incredible in the Polynesian islands. These groups were going long distances to discover new islands. I mean, sailing from Tahiti to Hawaii and all the way to Easter Island, Rapa Nui. And so given that technology, I think it's quite possible that they could have reached the coast of the Americas and then contacted Native Americans there. And then from that contact and returning, and we know that they would be do return voyages. There were voyages, trade voyages back and forth from Tahiti to Hawaii, et cetera, bring some of that genetic, material through connecting with the Native Americans and having kids together back to these islands. And what I think happened is that because it's the same exact Native American ancestry that we find on these few islands that have it, we think that the contact occurred with one community on one island, maybe voyaging to the coast of the Americas and then back again. And then when the most remote of these Polynesian islands were discovered and settled, the settlers brought with them that Native American, that small amount of Native American DNA in themselves, because they were already mixed. And so that's why we see it on several islands.
Professor Kaolu Fox, what can you flesh out a little bit more what that voyage might have been like, and why do we think that it was the Polynesians who were voyaging to the Americas and bringing DNA in the form of, you know, children or you know, wives or whatever, partners back to the islands? Why do we think it happened that way rather than, I mean, couldn't it have been that some enterprising indigenous peoples from the American continent got on a canoe and voyaged out and settled on one of these islands that was already populated by Polynesians?
Right. Okay. So here's the thought experiment. You have the greatest navigational culture in the history of humanity who has iteratively improved technologies, including the outrigger, the shapes of the sails, the scientific knowledge to understand the celestial sphere at night, bird migration patterns, wind and weather patterns, all of this accumulation of this biological metadata, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have one community who has done that, has a proven track record of doing this over time for thousands of years, iterating and perfecting exploration as a voyaging community. And then you have another community that may or may not have had one raft that potentially, you know, like a lottery mechanism, makes it over in one direction against all odds. So mathematically, one scenario is way more probable than the other.
And the South American, you're saying the indigenous people of South America did not have a culture of seafaring that we're aware
not
of.
Like this, okay. not nothing remotely even close to the wayfinding capacities of my ancestors. And so in that sense, it's far more likely. And there's so many different lines of evidence to support this in terms of other things like the sweet potato. There are other stories around.
Wait, the sweet
chicken,
potato. Did the sweet potato originate in South America, we believe?
It did. It did originate in South America.
But it's common on the Polynesian Islands.
Right. Common amongst the Polynesian Islands. There are so many other lines of evidence in support of, you know, one direction versus the other. In this case, it's pretty cool, though, that Alex and everyone was able to detect this. But I think what's far more likely in what Alex is alluding to is that our ancestors make it to South America. Maybe they stay for a generation. They get back on the waka, the boat, and then they go back to where they're from because they know it exists and they know it's there. And you have to understand, within our communities, the ocean isn't a barrier. It's something that connects us. We are identified by the moana. When we say the word moana, in most Polynesian languages, that means the ocean. We are connected by this. We're not separated. It's not a barrier like in other cultures. So I think people need to really understand that epistemological phenomenon.
Is there cultural evidence in the culture of the Polynesian island peoples that they had contact with South America?
I mean, there is this word that I alluded to. That's the closest thing that we have. So it's in some Polynesian languages, Kumara. Kumara and others, which is related to the Kumar or Kumal word used for the sweet potato on the coast of South America. So you have this crop, which was domesticated in Central and South America, which is also in Polynesia somehow. It was there before the Europeans showed up. We can see that from carbon 14 dating. And the word being used looks very similar on the Polynesian islands and in the Americas. And so there's always been this suggestion that somehow that crop did come from the Americas, and the name for it came as well to Polynesia.
And Professor Fox, finally, what about in terms of the folklore or the histories? Are there Polynesian peoples that would look at this DNA analysis and say, well, duh. I mean, we've been telling our kids this since time immemorium.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are so many different lines of evidence, and I'm sure that we are, you know, including our mo'olelo, our cultural history, and the places that that our ancestors have traveled to and continue to travel to with the Renaissance in voyaging and wayfaring, you know, communities through the Polynesian voyaging society that's currently going on and new expeditions that they have going. I think what's going to happen is the more information we survey, the higher resolution map of our accomplishments as the greatest voyaging community that, you know, our civilization has ever known will come into higher resolution.
It sounds like you're especially keen to see your people get the credit that they are due for their for the accomplishments of your ancient ancestors. Professor Ioannidis, what are you keen to see proven or established as a result of this work?
Well, I mean, I think it was very exciting that we were able to show that you have this sort of sensitivity with the modern methods that we've been developing. And I think what I'd like to see next is really a further investigation just of the genetic structure of, you know, Polynesia, but other populations around the world in general. I think we can do a lot with modern DNA and helping people to you know, rediscover the past, especially these incredible stories that are not recorded necessarily. They're not the stories of the kings and queens that made it into books, but they're in fact maybe even more incredible than those stories. And we can tell them with people's DNA, which, you know, sort of has your story, your family ancestral story written in it.
That's Alexander Ioannidis, who works at the Institute for Computational and Mathematical Engineering at Stanford University. Keolu Fox is an anthropology and genomics professor at UC San Diego. We spoke with the two of them last summer. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Once a week, the Top of Mind team dives into the archives for conversations that we'd like to hear again. Hope you're enjoying our selections today. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, how Feb Burns' letter to her son, a member of the Tennessee State House, helped give American women the right to vote. Stay with us. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind Prime Cuts today. I'm Julie Rose. During the 100th anniversary celebrations of women's suffrage in America over this last year, we learned the amazing story of the young Tennessee lawmaker who cast the deciding vote to ratify the 19th Amendment and give women the vote nationwide. Harry T. Byrne had been leaning against voting for the amendment, but then at the last minute, he got a letter from his mother and changed his mind. Here's my conversation with Harry Byrne's great-grandnephew, Tyler Boyd. We spoke last August. By all accounts, the vote was pretty dramatic on August 18th, 1920. Tennessee lawmakers are in special session. The 19th Amendment is on the table. How had your great-granduncle been leaning on this issue of women's suffrage heading into the special session?
When he left Niota to attend the special session in early August, he had been planning to vote yes for women's suffrage. Well, when he got over there, there was all sorts of pressure coming at him from all sorts of different directions. His constituents were really split down the middle on the issue, but he had been misled into believing they were overwhelmingly against it. His party leader in McMinn County said over 90% opposed. The county judge and the county election commissioner said, "We adjourned court, we had a mass meeting, and they're all riled up." And these are his most prominent constituents from both parties, Democratic and Republican. But then he also receives phone calls from Warren Harding and James Cox, candidates for president, asking him to vote yes. He receives a letter from Woodrow Wilson's attorney general asking him to vote yes, and from Will Hayes, chairman of the RNC.
Was he the only one getting this kind of pressure?
The national leaders contacted all of the state legislators, asked them to vote one way or the other. So Harry wasn't special in this regard. But instead of listening to them, he listened to his constituents, who he thought was overwhelmingly opposed. So he started to caucus with the Red Rose Brigade. A red rose meant you were against suffrage. Yellow rose meant you were for suffrage. So on August 18th, he walks onto the House floor wearing a red rose and the lapel of his jacket. And the suffragists are very disappointed because they thought that he might vote with them, but it looked like he had turned to the dark side. So Speaker Walker, who's trying to kill the amendment by tabling it, which is just a delay tactic to bring it up later, which wasn't going to happen, Harry Byrne votes yes to table on both votes, and it results in a 48-48 tie.
Okay. And just let's just pause for a moment and talk about Harry Byrne. He was really young at this point in his life.
Yes, he was elected in 1918 at the age of 22. And during this special session, he was 24 years old. He was the youngest member of the entire state legislature and only had a 3-year high school degree. So no college, no law school, nothing like that. Just an ordinary citizen.
Any idea why he ran for office?
Well, my late cousin, Harriet T. Byrne Jr., believed that part of his inspiration was when his sister, Sarah, passed away a few years before this. He kind of felt called to public service to fill that void. But he had always been interested in politics. His mother, Feb Byrne, said that he was always well-read as a child. He kept up with all sorts of the news, not just local, but national, international. And he always wanted to be in public service. So it wasn't really a surprise that he got into politics.
So the special session comes down to a tie on the 19th Amendment. And Harry had been voting and thought that his constituents wanted him to vote against the 19th Amendment. But then he changes his mind at the last minute and even yanks off the red rose off his lapel, right? So what was it that changed his mind?
On the morning of the vote, on August 18th, a House page was delivering everybody their mail for the day. And among a sheaf of telegrams and letters, Harry received a letter from his mother, Feb Ensminger Byrne. The weekend before, she had read in the newspapers Harry's mentor from her state Senate district had given a very racist and sexist speech against woman suffrage. She actually called it a bitter speech. So she was inspired to write a letter to her son, who she knew was conflicted and had all sorts of pressure coming from so many different ways. And in the letter, she works in her message very persuasively. It wasn't admonishing. She says, "Hoorah, vote for suffrage and don't keep them in doubt." And then a few pages later, she says, "Don't forget to be a good boy and help Mrs. Cat with her rats." Is she the one that put rat in ratification?
Carrie Chapman Catt, right? The president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association.
Yeah, it's referring to a political cartoon in favor of ratification. So Harry reads that letter and he puts it in his inside jacket pocket and he has it with him when he casts that deciding vote, because on the third roll call, it was a vote on the merits of the resolution. It had to have a majority. It would fail. And he took his mother's advice and realized the amendment would fail without him. So he cast that tie-breaking vote, and it was pandemonium in the House chamber. But the next day, he defended his vote and gave his mother all the credit.
Oh, he even admitted that he'd received that letter, and she's the one that had convinced him.
Yes, proudly. Proudly admitted that.
Huh. Tell us about his mom, Feb Byrne. Was this kind of letter from her kind of guiding him on his political activities unusual, do you think?
Well, certainly in those times, politics was not considered to be part of the women's sphere at all. And there's even a reference to his political career on page 4. She says, "Surely you've seen enough of politicians to know it's not the greatest thing to be one." I think that's her way of saying, don't worry about re-election, you know, do what's right.
Mm.
But she did encourage his career. And, you know, see, she is the daughter of a disabled Confederate veteran. And I think about the amazing change, positive change she saw in her lifetime from 1870s all the way to World War II when she passed away. You see, she doesn't even inherit the family farm when her husband dies, but she's managing it very successfully. She's paying the taxes. And her farm workers, some of them can't even read, but they can vote and she can't. And she thought that was very, very unjust. And that's why she wrote to her son. And thankfully, he took her advice, even though he was a grown man. And at the time, you know, the oldest boy was the man of the house when the dad was gone. But nevertheless, he deferred to the matriarch who he loved and respected.
Did Feb Byrne have an education?
Yeah, she attended Grant Memorial University in Athens, Tennessee, which is now Tennessee Wesleyan University. And she worked as a teacher for a little while before she got into farming. So she was one of the more well-educated women of her time.
Mm. It's a really eloquent letter. You can find it in your book and also online. It was recently published in the Washington Post on their website as well. What do you think Feb would make of her fame as kind of being, you know, the mother who convinced her son to ratify the 19th Amendment?
Well, from reading the newspapers when they interviewed her 100 years ago, she didn't really want to be that famous. She didn't really seek fame. Whenever the reporters came to her house, she said, "I'll talk to you. Well, I'm going to do my farm work while we're talking." You know, she didn't really try to use it for any sort of public career or anything like that, and didn't really try to get in the spotlight. She just answered their questions graciously and said, I believe in suffrage as a right for all people. I believe in my rights as a mother, my rights as a woman, and I'm proud of my son. He covered himself in glory. She had absolutely no regret. She said, I don't care what people think of me. Some people think that my son's done the wrong thing, and some people think I should be ashamed of my son, but I'm not. I'm very proud of him. Hmm. So she handled the publicity really well.
Did she get pressure to convince her son to change his vote, to go back on what he'd done?
Yes. Mrs. Ruffin G. Pleasant, wife of a former Louisiana governor, showed up to the Burns family home in Iota uninvited and stayed for hours trying to convince my great-great-grandmother to call or wire her son and ask him to change his vote on the reconsideration, which thankfully failed. And she said no. And after a few hours, she had to ask this lady to leave her house. She said her name was Pleasant, but she sure didn't act like it.
Oh, boy. You never got a chance to meet Feb, did you?
No. She passed during World War II. And I wish I'd asked my grandfather more about her, but I just didn't think. I asked him about his parents and not his grandparents. That's one of my regrets.
Yeah. How much was this story a part of your family legacy, the lore that you grew up with, Tyler Boyd?
Well, when I first got into history and social studies, it was in the seventh grade. And that's when I first learned about my family's fortunate connection to Harry T. Byrne and Feb Byrne. We were studying Tennessee history, and my mother said, be sure to tell your teacher about my great uncle, Harry T. Byrne, and him casting the vote for woman suffrage. And that's when I first learned what suffrage meant and how the amendment process worked. And it didn't really hit me what a really big deal it was. I got to be a voting age myself because it's enfranchised half the country. And I cherish the memories of visiting with Harry T. Byrne Jr., my late cousin, only child, old bachelor. He shared some interesting stories with us. He bequeathed to me some very precious artifacts, memorabilia, heirlooms, things like that, which I really treasure. And it was certainly a big part of my junior high school and college years growing up.
Tell me a little more about the blowback that Harry T. Byrne experienced after he cast that deciding vote to ratify the 19th Amendment, making it official across the country that women could vote. Did he get reelected after that?
Yes, barely. The anti-suffrage newspapers in Tennessee, specifically the Nashville Banner and the Chattanooga Times, they printed completely fabricated stories saying that he was bribed $10,000 to switch his vote, and that some women did him some favors for switching his vote. And they tried to call him a draft dodger during World War I because he got a deferment because he worked as a railroad telegrapher for the Southern Railway, which was a very important work to do back home during the war. A lot of women did a lot of important work during the war, too. So he has to make a canvas, as I said in those days. He had to go out there and campaign for reelection and work really hard, but he credited the women for his reelection. Over 900 women in McMinn County at the time, 25,000 people, registered to vote that October, and he said, without them, I would have lost. And he won by less than 300 votes. And I just am really, really happy to know that his constituents rewarded him by giving him another term in the state house.
Yeah. I wonder if Feb was happy with that, if she wanted him out of politics.
She voted for the first time.
Feb voted for the first time in that election for her son.
Yeah, she was 47 years old, and she finally got to cast a ballot for her son in November 1920.
Oh, that's amazing. Are there any records about what Feb thought about being a voter?
Well, I don't know if this was an indication that she got up early and jumped in line to be first, or if it was a matter of courtesy on the part of the Election Commission, but she received the first voter registration card for the general elections registration cycle on October 1920. We actually have her voter card preserved at the McClung Collection in Knoxville, the same place that has her letter, and it has all the male pronouns. His voter registration number is 1, his civil district is 4, so she got the first voter card for that election cycle. So I'm sure they gave that to her as a matter of courtesy. But who knows? She may have just been there early and said, hey, I want to get my voter card right now. So.
Yeah, that's amazing. Also, that the system was so used to only having men voting that they hadn't even, like, reworked the cards so that it could say her or Mrs. or she.
That's right.
Wow. Did Harry remain true to that vote for women's suffrage? Where did his record fall on issues of women's access and equality for the rest of his political career?
One thing I learned in my research is that his political career was just getting started in 1920. The next year, he introduced a bill called the Equal Guardianship Law. It repealed an old Tennessee law from the 1850s that allowed fathers to will away their children to anyone, even a stranger, in the event of their death without the mother having any say-so. He got that legislation signed into law in 1921, and he went on to author a bill in the 1950s in the state Senate to permit women to serve on juries. And he was in and out of state government for a long time throughout the rest of his life, and he fought for universal suffrage. He voted to get rid of Tennessee's poll tax. He fought to lower Tennessee's voting age, which took forever. It actually didn't happen until federal action in the 1970s. Hmm. And he fought against gerrymandered legislative districts. He fought against a lot of election fraud that had been happening in his district. And I was really, really impressed to learn that. So he continued his activism for universal suffrage throughout the rest of his life.
You're a high school civics teacher, is that right?
Yes, I have taught civics in the past. Currently, I'm a teaching assistant, but I have taught high school U.S. history and government many times in the past as an interim or substitute or a virtual online teacher. And I always enjoy teaching about this story and showing the students that this is a young person, doesn't have a lot of name recognition like a Bush or a Clinton or a Kennedy or someone like that. Doesn't have a lot of money, but he got engaged in local politics. And look at the difference he made. Look at how one vote mattered. And he was from right down the road in Iota. It's about 30 minutes from where I teach in Lenore City. So It's always great to teach that lesson, and hopefully it inspires them to get involved.
That's Tyler Boyd, descendant of Feb Byrne, the mother whose letter helped make Tennessee the 36th state to ratify the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote nationwide. Boyd has written a book about his family's role in women's suffrage. It's called Tennessee Statesman Harry T. Byrne. Top of Mind Prime Cuts is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. I'm Julie Rose. Every week, the Top of Mind team combs through our archives to select conversations that deserve another listen. We've got some fun stuff for you today. This hour, a protocol expert on how to have respectful conversations about sensitive subjects. Then meet an actor with a lower leg amputation who does all his own stunts, and he wants actors with disabilities to have a chance at all roles, not just the ones where the character has a disability. Also, how to predict which city neighborhood that is will gentrify next. It's coming up on Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It seems like angry outbursts, personal attacks, and name calling are just the norm in American public life these days. If you watch cable news or spend any time on social media, you know what I'm talking about. How are we supposed to talk respectfully about sensitive but important topics while we're swimming in this sea of hostility? Shelby Scarborough can point us in the right direction. She worked as a protocol officer at the White House and State Department. She helped create the conditions for President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev to meet and negotiate. Let's see what she can do for the tough conversations in our lives. Scarborough's book is called Civility Rules, and I spoke with her last fall just after it was published. What is a lesson from your work in the Reagan administration that could translate to two friends or two coworkers talking about something important on which they disagree?
Well, I think one of the most famous examples of that with my first boss, who was Ronald Reagan, was his relationship with the then Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. They were political adversaries to the core. They believed in the core values were the same. They believed in America. They believed in doing the right thing for the people, but they disagreed on the way to do that. So they had lots of great debates, but at the end of the day, they'd go have a beer and they made sure to laugh and smile and enjoy each other's company and separate the two, the business from the pleasure, so to speak. Hmm.
Did it matter, or were they able to somehow always remind themselves that fundamentally their disagreement was not about core values? Like, they both wanted the same thing for America. Like, how important is that for interpersonal dialogue in general when we disagree with people?
Yeah. So one of the best places is to start with trying to find your common humanity, the things you have in common. You know, why do we want to jump into the most difficult conversations right away? So when we have really good friends, it's a little easier. Sometimes it's a little easier to talk about subjects that we disagree on because we have already formed a bond of respect and trust with one another. But if you're running into a stranger, why do we want to pick a fight? Why don't we try to find what we have in common first?
If someone tells me to behave civilly, the message I take away is that I'm supposed to keep my mouth shut, keep quiet, be polite. What is your definition, your vision of civility?
Mine is actually almost the exact opposite. Huh. This isn't about being nice. Although that's a component, it isn't about being silent and keeping your mouth shut and not speaking your mind. This is about developing a skill set where we can speak our mind in a way that others can hear it. And this is one of the biggest gaps I see in society today, is we are not, the listener isn't tolerant and the talker isn't speaking in a language that the listener can hear. But we also say, we're also pointing fingers at everybody and saying they're the ones who are incivil or intolerant. And really the bottom line is it starts with us and our behavior. And we have to model the behavior that we want to see. And that's very Gandhi-esque. But it's very true.
Wait, can you give an example of speaking your mind in a way that others can hear?
Sure. So tactically speaking, there are some things that we can do. One is to listen to learn and learn to listen. So while we're listening to somebody else's dialogue, like, for example, when you're asking me questions, I'm listening to what you're saying so that I can try to respond appropriately to you in a way that you would understand my response. And if I came back to you with, how could you think that way? Then the first response you would have would be a defensive mechanism, and you would tend to shut down and start questioning yourself or get angry. What's the point of that? That doesn't get us anywhere. Mm. So listen to learn and learn to listen. The other would be to ask clarifying questions. So if this is a subject that you're treading in territory where you vehemently disagree, or maybe you just don't know enough about it, that's the humility that we need to bring to the table to say, you know what, I need to know more about this subject from your perspective, and ask clarifying questions about their perspective instead of trying to insist on our own views. Look, I'm the first one that you started this with saying you can be an uncivil person. The very first words of my book are, I can be uncivil. Mm. And this is something that I've developed as a practice of civility. So this is like yoga or medicine or law. We have to keep up with it. We have to keep going in order for this to be effective. We can't just, it's not a light switch you turn on and off.
You just gave a couple of examples of how to have a civil conversation, but they both had to do with listening and asking questions. They didn't actually mm-hmm. have to do with me expressing my viewpoint. So is there
yes.
magic?
So
is
I
there some magical
that,
piece
yes.
on the how do I say what's on my mind in a way that also keeps the conversation civil?
Yes. Thank you for getting me back to that. It is about, I would say, saying it in a way that you don't offend the other person, but we have to be careful. Everything seems to offend everybody. So part of it is the other person has to take some responsibility, but you can't force them to do that. So I think it's about looking ahead and seeing what is the impact you're trying to have. Can you phrase things in a way that are open-ended, open-minded, phrase them as a question, not questioning them, but saying things like, in my experience, so that if, you know, it's hard to take away somebody's personal experience. If we're just spitting out opinions and conjecture or repeating things we've heard on television, there's not a lot of credibility in that. So the responsibility we have to take is that when we speak, we're talking from our own experience or our own perspective. And that's something that's harder to dispute. They may not still agree, but it's harder to argue with.
Do you have to help me understand this? How the disagreement plays out, though, in a respectful mm-hmm. conversation, because it sometimes mm-hmm. can feel like if you don't challenge a viewpoint that you disagree with, it can feel like you are conceding or compromising
right.
your own values.
So I think you can say, I hear you, but I kind of disagree, or I disagree with that perspective, or let's investigate that a little further and try to tease the issue apart a little bit. if you're saying, I guess it gets back to when you're saying, can you say something without offending somebody, or how do you express yourself? It's really important for us to be able to do that, because freedom of speech is such a core value in this country, so important. And I do believe that it's a bigger issue than just being able to have a conversation. I think it's about keeping our democracy, because if only one voice is allowed in the room, there is no democracy in the end. And this is a responsibility of each of us as a citizen to welcome divergent views and to be able to encourage the discussion. So if I have a lot of friends who think differently than I do, particularly in politics. And we have good discussions. Sometimes it gets a little touchy, but we learn to dial it back a little bit and say, you know, maybe we should take a break, or maybe we should agree to disagree. But we want to part friends. We don't want to make enemies of the other person.
Where's the place, though, for calling out something that is wrong? A racist comment or a racist viewpoint, for example, what does civility in the face of bigotry look like?
Yes. Okay. So I understand your point completely. I mean, of course, there are lines in the sand that are not acceptable in society. You know, racism is just not acceptable. But I really would push us to think, who is the arbiter of what is a racist statement? Now, obviously, to me, there are some very clear delineations, right? There's some very obvious things. But sometimes it's not so obvious. And sometimes the person who may have said something isn't necessarily meaning to be racist. They just don't realize that there's a nuance that there's so many tripwires now in society and things that are hard to know whether that's going to be taken offense to. And I think that this is where we have to just give the benefit of the doubt to somebody else and say, I've had people say, well, you know, do you think that comes from your perspective on this? Or, you know, asking the clarifying question instead of attacking that person and saying, I think you're wrong. You know, clearly we have, I'm not talking about the obvious good and evil extremes. Okay. There are extremes that I think most people in society would understand were not acceptable behavior. And that's either you exit the scene, you say, I hear you, but this is not a conversation that I can have. But I would caution us to to determine that we're the arbiters of what that is, that we need to come to the table with humility and ask ourselves, maybe we are wrong on a certain situation, because this is part of the divergent views in the society that we're so sure that we're right, that where there's no room for any discussion. And we can't change somebody else. The only thing we can do is change how we behave. And in the end, I'm hopeful that will ultimately change all of us.
I'm speaking with Shelley Scarborough, who is author of the book Civility Rules. She's a speaker, entrepreneur, a former protocol officer in the U.S. State Department and the White House, worked for President Ronald Reagan, among others. So you, Ms. Scarborough, were involved in putting together many, many high stakes diplomatic meetings between world leaders. Is there a world leader you found whose example of civility in tense situations was inspiring to you?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, I feel like my first boss is a great example. He was always civil to everybody.
This is Ronald Reagan, President Reagan.
This is President Reagan. No matter what, no matter who the person was, whether it was the person who brought water into the Oval Office to a head of state, he was kind and civil and gracious and thoughtful. Going on from there, though, one of my favorites was once I went out into the private sector and started my own business, my very first client was Nelson Mandela of South Africa. And it was when he had come over straight out of prison. It was his first trip to the United States. He hadn't become president of the country yet. He was just right out of prison. And he set an example for the world on civility by loving his enemy, basically. The people who imprisoned him, he did not extract revenge. He sat down with them. He, in a way, embraced them and tried to move forward, because he ultimately knew that carrying that anger and hate and all of those negative emotions around that are so easy to understand that he might have after being in prison for so long, that was unnecessary emotions, and it wasn't going to benefit anyone.
You boil the rules for civility down to five key characteristics: courtesy, humility, empathy, trust, respect. Would you expand for us on one of those that you think is particularly lacking in today's society?
So I go back to humility as being one of the core ones, because we're so sure of ourselves sometimes that we forget to come to the table with a little bit of a sense that we could learn something from someone else. And there, especially in politics, in other areas, you know, especially it's like when you first learn a subject, you become really engrossed in it and very knowledgeable. But, you know, if you're talking to the professor, you might be not so knowledgeable. So there's a spectrum of our knowledge, and we need to recognize that we're always learners in this society and in life, and to come to the table as a lifelong learner instead of a know-it-all. And that's, so this is what's hard for me, is talking sort of as a quote expert on this, because it feels like I feel a lack of humility even talking about it from this perspective. You know, there's an irony for me.
To some extent, did you wonder what you were even doing writing this book at this particular moment? It comes out just before a presidential election when things could not be more hostile or tense.
Yes. In fact, I've been writing about this for about 10 years. The first step I took on this was writing a chapter for another book, a composition type book. And I wrote a chapter on political civility. And it, unfortunately, it kind of came to me in that study that civility has been lacking in politics for forever, basically. There's been, you know, the term mudslinging existed for a reason. And now I think kind of the big difference is that we're, instead of the politicians being on a stage throwing mud at each other, we're kind of invested in it personally. And so now we're slinging mud at each other ourselves. And we're, because of the 24-hour news cycle where you've just got opinion after opinion coming in, because of the polarization of the news media, picking sides and not being quite so down the middle as they used to be, you know, no more Walter Cronkites, that kind of thing. And then social media, where the absence of responsibility personal responsibility has really been a big part of shining the light on the fact that we throw stones and then run away and don't have to take the consequences of it sometimes.
I almost, as I was reading through your book and thinking this through, it seems to me like being civil is almost looked down upon in some public life. Like if you're not, you know, the people applaud you when you retaliate or lash back or even name call. That it's not just that that's accepted, but that it's applauded in some way.
Mm-hmm. And this is what's frustrating, is it's not deep down. I mean, I sense that you are responding to that in a sense that that doesn't please you. That isn't something that makes you feel good about life in general, is that that's become kind of a norm. Mm-hmm. And it's become somewhat, I wouldn't call it acceptable. You don't accept it. It's just sort of what it is, right? So how do we change that is really the question. And it seems like such a big issue. It's so huge. Like, how could we ever make a change for all of society? But I would say that the only way to do that is to start. And that's why I'm talking about this. I'm hoping that people will accept a practice of civility of their own. Civility is not a weakness. It's a strength, because it takes a lot more patience to not retaliate, not rebuke someone, to try to understand who you're talking to and what they're saying, even if it's really divergent from your own value system, and to honor the fact that they have their reasons for it.
That's Shelley Scarborough, a former protocol officer at the White House and the U.S. State Department. Her book is Civility Rules, which came out in October of 2020. That's when I first spoke with her. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut of the show. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, why food is the best indicator that a city neighborhood is gentrifying. Just ahead, the double standard in Hollywood casting that traps a lot of actors with disabilities in limited roles. I'm Julie Rose. It is great to have you with us today for Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly director's cut of the show, a selection of curated conversations from the archive. It has become socially and politically unacceptable for a white actor to play a person of color on screen. But those casting rules don't apply to disabilities. The vast majority of characters with disabilities in film and television are portrayed by actors who do not have that same disability. And not only that, it's considered acceptable. Those actors often get all kinds of Oscar buzz for portraying the disability so convincingly. But if you're an actor with a disability, you'll probably only ever get cast to play characters with that same disability. It's a double standard that actor Kurt Yeager has been caught in many times. He has a lower leg amputation, and he's an activist for disability rights in entertainment. He's been in NCIS, Sons of Anarchy, LA's Finest, Another Life, which is a Netflix show. That's just to name a few. I spoke with actor Kurt Yeager in November. Let's listen. Your leg was amputated after a motorcycling accident in 2006. You've told your story a lot publicly. Were you an actor before that accident?
No, I wasn't. I was actually getting my master's in hydrogeology. So a whole different field.
Yeah. So how did you get into acting then, knowing that it might be difficult with a disability like that?
It just sort of happened. A friend of mine connected me with a few people, and I immediately had an audition for a role, and they liked me, and all of a sudden I found myself on set of a movie called Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks and Amy Adams, and directed by Mike Nichols. And I just did a lot of research and realized that this was something that not only did I always wanted to do, but the near-death experience of my motorcycle accident made me realize that life was extremely short and I really needed to go after what I wanted to do. So I decided on pursuing the career in acting.
Yeah. How often are the parts that you get, and you've been quite successful, your credits are quite long, how often are the parts that you get not written as someone with a lower leg amputation?
Being a lower limb amputee, it's like called a BK, so below knee amputee. Amputees, we call that a paper cut because it's like really the easiest amputation you can have. And when I wear pants, for instance, you can't tell that I'm an amputee. I don't really have a limp. I don't have any gait issues. If I'm at the supermarket buying bananas, for instance, no one thinks anything of me. But if I'm wearing shorts, people are like, oh, thank you for your service. And I'm like, what? And I'm like, I didn't serve in the military, sorry. And they're like, oh, what happened? And I'm like, it's a motorcycle accident. And they say, oh, that was dangerous. And you're like, oh, I know. And so you start getting a completely different reaction. And in the casting world, you know, in order for everyone to understand what type you are and whatnot, people try to remember you for references. And if they remember that you're a wheelchair user or an amputee, then they start categorizing you in that way. And if the character in the breakdowns from a script are written in a way that says, hey, we want to see a lower limb amputee, as in your intro, they'll see amputees sometimes, and they'll see ambulatory actors. But if it's just an ambulatory role, they won't necessarily see an amputee.
Right.
So the double standard is access to the room for opportunity.
You have to include, I guess. I mean, are you ever able to hide it? Like just show up for an ambulatory role and just wear pants so they can't see?
Yeah, that's happened many, many times. I've done, I don't know, maybe 45 commercials, and maybe two of them had to do with being an amputee. I've done multiple TV shows, one with Rob Lowe, where they didn't have any idea I was an amputee. I did, I think, General Hospital. I wasn't an amputee. And then that show, Lethal Weapon, which was the remake of the movie, I was riding motorcycles and running around on a beach and shooting guns and doing all these other things. And they had no idea I was an amputee.
Like nobody on the set knew you were an amputee?
No. No, had
not
no
even
clue.
Like the stunt directors?
Not until, not even them. Not until the like sixth day where it was 105 degrees on the beach and even the cameras were breaking and we had to take a lot of breaks for actors just to breathe. And about halfway through, I had to take off my pants and take off my leg and dump the sweat out of the leg because it was so hot. So then people were shocked that a guy with one leg was riding motorcycles and running around as fast as I was.
Yeah.
So it's quite shocking. And
you do a lot of your own stunts. You do a lot of really physical work. You were a BMX racer before the accident, mm-hmm. right? Are you doing some of that intentionally because you want to defy the stereotype and you want to make sure that you don't get limited in any way in terms of casting or the way they write your character once they find out that you're missing a leg?
I try to really push the limits of the juxtaposition of my physical abilities and disability, because disabilities are often written in a way that I guess a white writer would have written a black character in the 60s, you know, from a distant place where they don't know anything about culture, anything about personalized experiences. And so when they write these characters, most of the time they're not disabled themselves, or they don't have any friends or family or disabilities in their direct circle. So they're writing from what they know about disabilities in popular culture, which is mostly misnomers.
So there's a general frustration, it sounds like, among, and I know that even though you describe your amputation as your disability as being minor on the scale. I know that you're an activist. You're involved in advocating for disabled performers, working with the performing unions. So, describe some of the frustrations that people who can't hide their disability so easily, in fact, maybe can't hide it at all. They have cerebral palsy or they use a wheelchair and they can't get up and run around. You know, what are some of the frustrations that those individuals have with the roles that they can get, with the way that the role is written? Expand on your frustration with how people with disabilities are written into popular culture.
I mean, that is a very, very large question. We could probably spend a half hour just on that. I mean, there's basic things like accessibility to auditions. So, for instance, unless a casting office is looking for a very specific deaf actor, they're probably not going to be reading non-deaf roles and thinking, oh, this could be interesting, because they don't have an interpreter. Or, for instance, my good friend Danny Woodburn, who's a little person, you know, he's got a hip issue. If it's on the second story of a building and it's not an elevator access, well, then he can't get up, neither can anybody else using wheelchairs. So there's a physical accessibility component, but casting directors aren't necessarily to blame either, because they get the material that's already written. They're not in that creative process of writing. They are suggesting people for these characters, and often there's not a lot of time. So a character will be written, and they, let's say it's a 35-year-old guy, handsome, fit, can do his own stunts, and go. And they might not see me because they're like, well, he's an amputee, I'm not sure, and they move away from that. But from a writing perspective, a lot of people make the mistake of writing a wheelchair, for instance, as if it's a character trait, when all it is a mode of transportation. It doesn't make someone better or worse, angrier or happier, sad or happy. It's completely irrelevant to that person's lived experience. And most of the time what we see on television is just the either I'm a superhero, or I've learned great empathy because of my injury, or I'm miserable. I'm never just a father. I'm never just a father who happens to have one leg. I'm never the lover or the brother. I'm never the co-conspirator. I'm never the prankster. I'm just the sad guy, or the I'm going to teach everyone a lesson on empathy guy.
Or the veteran, right? I mean, you mentioned that people assume that when they see your the prosthetic, if you're in shorts, they're like, thank you for your service. They assume that you got it in the military. I did notice that, and maybe it's because you've guest appeared on a lot of NCIS episodes, but NCIS is, you know, kind of has this military background to it. But you play a lot of veterans in wheelchairs, you know, overcoming the trauma of your military service or whatever.
Yep. Yeah, it's definitely something that they're like putting in there, and you can see it's great. I'll take it all day long. Don't get me wrong, but a lot of times the character is it's written about the leg, right? Mm-hmm. It's written it's about the character's leg. Well, what about a character that already has the amputation and he's running full speed and doing his own thing and has a family, and we're not even going to talk about that? Or like my friends who use wheelchairs, like they're never ever written as somebody who is sexual. They're never written in a way that's like, oh, like she's an attractive woman who happens to use a wheelchair. So it's always very, very, how would I say it? It's like very simple, you know, it's
flat.
Like, it's a dumbed down version of reality, flat. Exactly.
So it starts with then having people who understand what living with a disability is like in the writing room, then you have to have them writing these characters.
100%. Because like on the show Rami, the guy, everyone's like, how did you think of writing a character with disabilities? Like my best friend has a disability.
Right. That one's striking because that one's really striking actually, because, and this is, I think Rami's on Hulu, but this is, his best friend is, has cerebral palsy, I think. But it's part of his character that there are a lot of things he can't do for himself, but he's a comedian. He is very funny the way he talks about, you know, his disability and kind of like uses it and toys with people. And it's a very unusual depiction that we're just not used to, because he's not the sort of like sad sack, sympathetic, oh, you know, our poor buddy, we have to kind of protect him all the time. Like sometimes he's even a jerk, which is so fascinating.
Exactly. Which is the funny part is that's written well because the person who's writing it is literally best friends with someone with cerebral palsy.
Yeah.
That's exactly the point. So we need more writers and producers and executives who have disabilities or are very, very good friends or have, you know, that in their family to be there. Vince Gilligan from Breaking Bad had a friend who grew up on his street who had CP, and that's why they wrote R.J. Mitty's character in to play Walt Jr.
I think there's a similar story with Speechless, with that that network comedy that had Minnie Driver in it, and there was one of the sons had cerebral palsy, and I think that the person who created that also had a brother in a similar situation.
Yep.
So it requires life experience. And then, at least in the two cases, a couple of the cases we've mentioned there, the part is actually played by someone who has that actual disability, right? What would happen if every disability that were depicted on screen were played by an actor who has that actual disability?
You'd probably see a lot of actors with disabilities winning Oscars.
Are there enough of them? Are there enough people with disabilities with the acting skill to fill all the roles that might come available when they're written for someone with a disability?
I think there is, and it's because I know a lot of people who have put the time in. I mean, having master's degrees, you know, MFAs in acting, and they are waiting in the wings in order to have the opportunity. But there is a distinguishable point between acting and auditioning. Mm. Those are two different skill sets. Major actors hate auditioning because it's completely separate and it's very difficult. And so imagine if you were an actor with a disability and you were allowed to audition twice a year, where another actor might be auditioning 30, 40 times a year. The skill set for the audition is so cold that it's much more difficult for the actor with a disability to come in and shine because they're not having the same kind of repetitiveness to their acting. Getting on set, once you're on set, I think it's easier to be an actor on set than it is to be in an audition room.
Sure.
Because you walk into an audition room and it's just somebody's office. There's no like special room. It's not like you see on TV. It's just an office. And, you know, let's say the casting directors got the family portrait on their table and they're like, you ready? And you're like, no. And you just got done sitting in the room where there's seven other people that look just like you. Mm. And it's very confusing and very jarring. Mm. And if you're not used to that, then your ability to even shine in that moment might not be as it wouldn't be able to come to fruition.
Right. So people with actors with disabilities need to be auditioned more. They need to be given the mm-hmm. chance to audition for roles, both for characters with disabilities and those without.
Yeah.
And then also, do you think though that there should be a rule that, just like now, you know, a lot of folks in Hollywood are saying, look, if you're a white actor, you should not be playing a person of color. Like, that's just not okay mm-hmm. anymore. Do you think that there should be a similar rule for playing a character with a disability, that you shouldn't be able-bodied and be allowed to do that?
Yeah, I think there's, like, nuance to that answer, but there's even division in the disabled community about that question, whether it should be or shouldn't be. Now, for me, I try to take a step back and look at, like, a tertiary perspective. I'm okay with an able-bodied person playing a disabled character, but after we get to the place where people with disabilities are employed at least a general number that Hollywood should be employing them at. So for instance, 20% of the population has some form of a disability, right? Mm. And on television, only 5% of the characters have a disability. But of those 5% of characters, 95% are played by able-bodied actors.
That's Kurt Yeager, an actor, producer, and activist for disabled performers. Among his current projects is the Netflix series Another Life. We spoke with him last fall. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. Coming up next, how to predict which city neighborhood will gentrify next. Here's a hint. Look for the trendy coffee shops. Thanks for tuning in today to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind Prime Cuts. It's our weekly staff picks version of the show. If you want to know which rough neighborhood in a city is about to become the next hipster enclave, watch to see where a new coffee shop opens up selling organic brews and green smoothies. An upscale restaurant is bound to follow the coffee shop, and then maybe a pop-up farmer's market on the weekend. And before long, you've got new condos and art spaces moving in, along with wealthier and often whiter residents. Why is a thriving food scene such a reliable precursor to gentrification? Joshua Sabika gave us some insight into this back in the fall. He's a professor of sociology at Colorado State University, co-editor of a book called A Recipe for Gentrification, Food, Power, and Resistance in the City. It's a Top of Mind Prime Cut. All right. So food, I mean, it hadn't occurred to me, but as I thought about it, you're right. Food is almost always the very first. It's an early, early signal that that's a neighborhood where, you know, 5-10 years from now, condos are going to be expensive. So what is it about food? Why would food, cafes and restaurants be like the early warning system?
It's a great question. And I would love to begin with just a quick refresher on gentrification itself to contextualize why food might matter.
Okay.
Really, really simply, gentrification is the process by which a neighborhood experiences disinvestment and economic decline that's then followed by revitalization. So food may be one of those tools of revitalization. And as you pointed out in your intro, money, wealthier and whiter people tend to move in and improve the housing and retail stock. And part of that retail stock could be new farm to table restaurants, cafes serving cortados or what have you. Mm. And in the US, you know, this isn't just an economic process, it's a racialized process. And so that's one piece that I hope we get a chance to get into today and thinking through not just why food is this marker of gentrification, but how it reflects differences in power and privilege between people based on their race and their class.
Right. Well, since you went there, let's go down that road just a little bit further. Paint a picture for me because I think it's interesting that you describe this as a cycle of disinvestment followed by investment, reinvestment, maybe. So could you describe for us, like, what would be going on in a neighborhood that is, that starts to decline? What would be the signs of that initially?
Sure. So I'll give an example. So I'm at Colorado State University, and an hour south of me is Denver, Colorado, a context I'm fairly familiar with. And there's a neighborhood that's referred to as Five Points. It's a historically African-American community, and it's a community that experienced redlining. So redlining was the process by which banks systematically refused to lend to communities of color, in this case, Black communities. And that structural process led to disinvestment. And as a result
meaning
of that—
Disinvestment by the government in terms of maintenance, parks, police?
In this case, it would be receiving loans, federally backed loans.
Okay.
And so loans could be used to improve, say, a business, a restaurant, or to even purchase better equipment for your home or improve your home. And so that process, just sort of fast forwarding for a very quick second, was one aspect through which a community didn't have the same kind of economic resources as communities in the suburbs.
I see. Okay.
And then over time, those communities don't have as much value in their land. And so they're seen by investors as places for further growing capital and building restaurants or building housing that's going to attract new people to the city that are willing to pay more than historically was in that community.
Right.
And so and a cafe could be one place where that happens.
Right. And there's a reason then, one specific reason why cafes, coffee shops, restaurants might look to a neighborhood like that and say, well, it's not really, the people who live there aren't currently in our demographic, but I think if we move there, we could draw the people who would come to our restaurant. One of the reasons they look at those neighborhoods is because of the cheap rent, right?
Exactly. And another reason, and this is one of the main arguments, at least among academics, but also I think activists point this out as well, is that there are cultural drivers of gentrification. So the aesthetics and tastes of the creative classes include things like wanting to be in a countercultural space where the urban aesthetics are cool, where there's a perceived opportunity for authentic living, where there's diversity, and that's actually tolerant of historically marginalized groups. And oftentimes that is in neighborhoods where there are immigrant communities or communities of color. And so a lot
and they're
of
not really opening
people look for that.
And these businesses are not, especially these restaurants, because they have such low margins. That's another thin margins. That's another thing you point out, that cheap rent really matters, because when you're, you know, selling food or coffee by the mug, you don't, you know, the margins aren't huge. And so it's attractive, but also they're not really moving there to serve the people who live in that neighborhood. They're kind of explicitly moving there to take advantage of the ambiance that feels edgy and cool to them, but they're banking on customers coming from other places.
Yeah, I think that's true. And so in this sense, it's not so much the food types that matter as what those food types represent for privileged eaters. And then the economic barriers to entry faced by long-term residents and actually running restaurants that capitalize on those changing tastes. So like kale smoothies or something of that sort.
Yeah.
And what I find really interesting about this is that this reflects actually a homogenization and standardization of tastes in a lot of American cities. Tunde Wei, he's a Nigerian chef and racial justice activist. He recently referred to this phenomenon as whateverware USA. And, you know, one way I interpret that is cities across the U.S., you can find essentially fancier versions of comfort foods that are part of the staple diets of many different ethno-racial groups. And for upwardly mobile eaters, or eaters who want to signal that they have omnivorous tastes or cosmopolitan tastes, that this often entails finding these foods in certain neighborhoods like banh mi's or Nashville hot chicken. And then over time, what's interesting is, you know, that neighborhood that's maybe an immigrant neighborhood becomes cool to visit for those kinds of foods. But then as it becomes cool, new restaurants move in. And so in later stages of gentrification, in a sense, the same foods themselves get gentrified and they start getting prepared by outsiders or locals wanting to attract more wealth to the neighborhood, but in these more upscale versions.
And a key piece of the gentrification process is that often the existing residents, whether it's an historically Black neighborhood or a primarily immigrant neighborhood, those individuals at some point end up not being able to afford to own a business, run a business, or own property or pay the rent in that neighborhood.
Exactly. And that's the displacement piece of this that's really critical. I think for a lot of folks that talk about gentrification, you know, they oftentimes use that word gentrification to mean displacement. And it's in those cases of displacement or the threat of displacement where there's the greatest resistance, where people want to stay in their neighborhood and they don't see the investment that's coming into their neighborhood benefiting long-term historic residents. And that's really the rub, is that economic piece. And then it's oftentimes made worse when those cultural foodways that may have been historically maligned for whatever reason as being unhealthy or poor food are all of a sudden turned into kind of hipster food. Like kale, I think, is a great example of this, where it's a food. I mean, it was used where I grew up in San Diego as like decoration and planters. You know, nobody ate kale. And then it was something, however, that's really significant in a lot of African-American communities and cuisines in places like New Orleans and
cooked
many
up,
other
cooked up more like a collard green or like a as a side dish. And then it became a salad, hipster salad and smoothie additive. And why is it that having a couple of hip hot restaurants in a neighborhood all of a sudden attracts the attention of condo owner, you know, condo developers and makes banks more willing to give loans into a neighborhood that has struggled to get any of that stuff for so long? Like, what's so magical about having a couple of hip restaurants there?
I think it signals the possibility that people are willing, and I should, by people, wealthier people specifically, are willing to move to a part of the city where there's an opportunity to exploit what's referred to as the rent gap, right? The difference between the prevailing and potential market rate for property. And so I think from a developer's perspective, they see the cultural significance of people moving, or I just say moving, but entering into neighborhoods that have been disinvested for so long, where there wasn't an opportunity to profit because, you know, the property markets were so inexpensive.
So sometimes we'll see, or often we'll see, communities when you get an expensive restaurant moving in, the residents in that community are frustrated because they can't even afford, you know, they can't afford to even go eat at that restaurant. It feels like interlopers, right? Taking over their space, maybe appropriating their flavors and their culture. But there are also cases, and so they'll maybe even protest that. But there are also cases where you describe one particularly poignant case where something will spring up that actually does benefit the locals in a neighborhood that that has struggled, like a community garden. So they're benefiting; it's a community garden, and then somehow that leads to gentrification. And they get squeezed out. Would you describe the example that you give from Denver again?
Yeah, absolutely. So this example is in the same neighborhood I described earlier, Five Points. There's a neighborhood within that called Curtis Park. And there was a piece of land upon which for decades there was affordable housing, an affordable housing complex. Eventually that complex was bulldozed and that land was empty for many, many years. Denver Housing Authority bought this land, and that's it's a housing authority that's charged with increasing affordable housing within the city. And they sat on the land for many years. The Great Recession happened and they were unable to offload it. So what they did was make it available to some urban farmers and a couple of urban farmers farmed on this land for several years. And in the course of farming on that land, that part of the city was becoming more attractive, both to developers, restaurants, cafes, and residents. And these farmers only had short-term lease until Denver Housing Authority could find a developer to build on site. And ironically, you know, the development that is now on this piece of property is called Spark. And that's short for Sustainability Park, which was the name of the park when there were urban farmers. So it's sort of cashing in on the cachet of the sort of environmentalism, sustainability ethos. And they advertise the fact that there were going to be community gardens for residents at these townhomes and apartments. And on top of one of the buildings on this property, there's a Japanese restaurant down below, and above is this really expensive vertical hydroponic farm system. And in this case, not only is this development contributing to gentrification in this neighborhood, but urban agriculture itself got gentrified. So urban farmers, really well-meaning, doing great work in the city, were caught up in economic processes that they couldn't really control. And
they got kicked off the land.
To have a capital-intensive hydroponic farm, there was no way that they were going to be able to stay on site.
Mm. So Joshua Spica, is there a way for these communities that need investment to have nice things, to have community gardens, to have a farmer's market, to have some urban farmers or a cafes and restaurants? Is there a way for them to have that, but also not get forced out ultimately by the gentrification process?
Absolutely. And the first thing that I would note is that urban agriculture and community gardens have been a longstanding practice in many immigrant communities, in many low-income communities, as survival strategies, as places to build resilience in the face of external pressures. So East New York Farms in New York, you know, one of the co-authors in A Recipe for Gentrification talks about East New York Farms really resisting efforts by the Giuliani administration back in the day to build housing. And the fact that there were community gardens there was something to rally around to resist that coming into their community and maintaining the cultural authenticity of that place. But that's just like one example. And I wanted to say that because there's often time, I don't want to,
we're almost out of time.
No examples.
We're almost out of time. So we're almost out of time. So summarize for me what could be done to make sure that the people living there don't get forced out after getting nice things.
Couple quick examples. Community benefit agreements for new retail that mandate pay and benefits that are commensurate with neighborhood's cost of living. So if a business comes in, that they sign this with the community. There can be neighborhood zoning that preserves local food businesses in the way that we have historical preservation for homes. So we can use zoning to actually support local businesses. The legal guarantee of living wages and full healthcare benefits for food chain workers and everybody, so that cities are affordable and so that when development happens, we all benefit from it. And making sure that a lot of longstanding food practices aren't pushed out. So the legalization and protection of food street vending businesses in places like Los Angeles, this has been a longstanding fight to make sure that communities can stay in place.
That's Joshua Spica. He's a professor of sociology at Colorado State University, co-editor of A Recipe for Gentrification, Food, Power, and Resistance in the City. All that talk about food made me hungry. Banh mi, especially. I love those sandwiches. Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Ciara Hewlett and Cleon Wall produce the show with help from Sam Faulkner, Abby Harrelson, Martha Harris, Cindy Jezik, Aubrey Johnson, Haley Kendall, and Olivia Young. Top of Mind Prime Cuts is produced by Ciara Hewlett and Kyle Riemond. We'd love to have you connect with us. We're on social media at BYU Top of Mind, or you can send us an email. Our address is topofmind@byu.edu. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.